It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The political rhetoric was expected to intensify as Election Day approached, and it did. But it's reached a whole new level in the hours and days after the polls across the country closed. Paul Johnson is a professor of communication and rhetoric at the University of Pittsburgh. His research focuses on argumentation, American politics, and race studies. Paul, welcome back to The Confluence.
Hi, Kevin. It's good to be back.
While Joe Biden said, remain calm and be patient, President Trump went before the White House press corps Thursday evening and said, quote, if you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us, end quote. He said many other things. But what did you hear in Donald Trump's words?
Well, I think the use of the adjective legal and the adjective illegal are really what stand out there. You know, typically, you know, election conversations in the United States, electoral discourse, you know, especially in the sort of modern era, less and less talk about illegal and legal votes and just talk about votes. So, you know, in bringing that adjective in, you know, Trump is trying to provide a lens for many of his supporters to interpret the results of the election where they can sort of make their own suppositions or inferences about the kinds of votes that are legal and the kinds of votes that are illegal. And so it's part and parcel of Trump's strategy of, you know, utilizing, right, kind of excessive, right, or extra descriptors to give his audience and his supporters a way to read reality in ways that are more comfortable or supportive for them. With the legal-illegal distinction, you know, perhaps working to assuage, right, or at least offer some measure of comfort and stability to people who are looking at a, you know, a popular vote tally and an electoral college tally that, you know, appear to have spoken against Trump and Trump's presidency in ways that might be difficult for them to process.
Some Republican leaders have reinforced the president's comments, including Senators Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham. However, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, a Trump ally, told ABC, we heard nothing about any evidence. This kind of thing, all it does is inflame without informing. More than 68 million people voted for Donald Trump and believe in him and maybe believe in his unfounded accusations. Is this language, can this language from Mr. Trump be dangerous?
Absolutely. And it's especially dangerous because the people that are, you know, sort of the present and future of the Republican Party's voting base aren't very much like Chris Christie. You know, but he's to an extent a man of a system and a man of a party. That's not true of Trump, and it's not true of Trump's most intense supporters, who certainly are, you know, view themselves in relationship to Trump in a kind of charismatic relationship to a political leader that's rather dangerous. But then also more broadly, you know, there's this view that Trump is their champion against a broader system from which they feel alienated. And those feelings of alienation will not just continue, but, you know, will probably intensify and grow no matter what somebody like a Chris Christie says. What matters a lot more is their broader information ecosystem and the tools they have available to process the reality of a Trump loss, which are few and far between.
Donald Trump has a way of presenting conspiracy theories and then says, I don't know if that's true. Is this presenting of information, then questioning it, a communication tactic, and has it been effective?
Well, absolutely. One of my colleagues at Texas A&M, Jennifer Machia, talks about this. Trump very often brings things up, but then sort of dismisses them as a kind of way of signaling to audiences that, you know, they might sort of wink, wink, nod, nod, you know, bring up the possibility and then dismiss it. But in fact, it's a kind of code. And it works because of the mistrust of the media and the establishment and the Washington swamp, right, and these other sort of figures that Trump has generated, because his supporters know that when he dismisses, you know, these conspiracy theories that he brings up, he's just doing that for the people who aren't clued in, right? So that the mainstream media and the Washington swamp, right, they're not getting the message. His supporters, right, his partisans are getting the message.
So the president's ardent supporters get it, what he really means, or there's a hidden message within his language, or what?
Well, there's one meta message, you know, and the meta message is, I'm right, and you're right, and nobody else has the authority, nobody else has the right to tell you that you're wrong. And so that message, whether or not it's, you know, found when he, you know, half refuses to disavow, you know, the QAnon conspiracy theory, or, you know, when he talks a lot about, you know, how he doesn't exactly know who the Proud Boys are, you know, or when he talks about how there's some issues with the votes, you know, and we're looking into it. The consistent message in all of those things is trust yourself and trust me, because we are separate from and different from this whole system, you know, that's being run by, you know, sex traffickers, and being run by the swamp, and being run by the mass media, and being run by globalists. The consistent message is, you're not them, I'm not them.
Paul Johnson is a professor of communication and rhetoric at the University of Pittsburgh. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Tennessee-based CBL Properties, which owns more than 100 malls across the country, including the Monroeville and Westmoreland malls in our region, has filed for bankruptcy. What's the future for those two malls, which for decades have served as symbols for retail business? Doreen Saletti is the director of the Marketing and Sales Program at Point Park University School of Business. Doreen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Glad to be here.
How much trouble were malls in general, and maybe particularly these two, before the pandemic?
Well, malls have been facing challenges for many years. Changing consumer behavior and expectations have led to changes in retail needs and retail operations, and that certainly has had an impact on malls.
Have vacancies been a major problem? Have there been closed storefronts available for occupancy in these big buildings?
There certainly have. Now, as retailers, you know, think about anchor stores at malls and some of the big box retailers like Macy's and JCPenney and Sears. As they have faced challenges, they have, you know, reduced the amount of space that they're leasing in malls and other shopping centers as well. And as those stores have faced some decline, you know, it's led to available space in retail locations like malls, sometimes significant, you know, 100, 150,000, 200,000 square foot spaces that have been available.
Have there been types of stores that have been particularly in trouble in malls, or is it across all sort of retail businesses within these buildings?
Well, there have been a number of challenges related to a variety of retail businesses. As shopping has shifted online in many cases and in many different areas of retail, it's affected, you know, retailers in a variety of ways. So, you know, whether it be clothing retailers or whether it be some specialty goods retailers, you know, that ability for consumers to have an omnichannel experience, they don't necessarily have to go into a physical store to make purchases, has really impacted, you know, a variety of different retailers kind of across the board.
The company says the malls will remain open while it implements its restructuring plan. Is shutting down an option? How likely would that be?
Well, there are some estimates that about 25% of the roughly 1,000 malls in the U.S. will close over the next 3 to 5 years. So there certainly is that possibility. At the same time, though, those who are looking to lease space in malls or those who are doing the leasing for the malls are trying to be more creative in how they bring different entities into those empty spaces. Here locally, Westmoreland Mall is looking at bringing a casino into the mall. A mall in Texas brought a community college into that space. A mall in Rhode Island converted retail space into micro apartments. So there are a number of different options that aren't necessarily tied directly to traditional retail as we think about it.
So the malls, are they having to re-envision themselves to survive? Maybe fewer retail stores as we know it, and using more space for whether it's other forms of entertainment or even other purposes, health, education.
Yeah, definitely. The trend toward entertainment in malls has been ongoing for some time now. Now, that's been curbed a bit by COVID. You know, movie theaters and restaurants were those hardest hit by, you know, stay-at-home orders and the concerns with, you know, pandemic spread. And so, you know, a number of malls had been moving toward more entertainment and experiential offerings, indoor skydiving, for instance.
Oh, my.
Right. So, you know, with that, the amount of space that's been available, looking at creative options, there are many different things that could potentially come into mall space.
So are they looking for more stable tenants? Because retail, as you notice, can be a little bit volatile as more and more stores count more heavily on online sales.
Yeah, that certainly could be part of it. You know, so when you're talking about things like, you know, residential space, medical facilities, educational facilities, they definitely could have an element of some stability to them.
Doreen, is there anything good about the demise of shopping malls? Does it promote a different type of shopping?
Well, one trend that we have seen is a revitalization of business districts. So we are seeing a lot of emphasis on business districts and their ability to facilitate shopping local, because business districts often have a mix of, you know, local retail plus some, they may have some chain or some national retail as well.
Finally, where will high school students get jobs without a traditional mall?
Well, there are still retailers, Kevin. So there are options, you know, related to restaurant retail, and there will still be, you know, store-based retail as well. So I don't think that the declining nature of malls and some on-ground retail is going to have a significant impact on our high school students.
Doreen Saletti is the director of the marketing and sales program at Point Park University School of Business. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania Department of Human Services has distributed more than $400,000 in grants to shelters serving families experiencing homelessness and domestic violence survivors and their families. One of the recipients is the Women's Center and Shelter of Greater Pittsburgh. Anita Hammond is the Children's Program Supervisor for the center. Anita, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The funding is to improve internet access and support purchase of computer equipment for parents and children to use while staying at the shelter. Currently, what would you say the state of technology is at your shelter?
You know, it was pretty low at this point when we noticed that there was a grant, and we do appreciate and applied for the grant. We were able to purchase some items that was needed for our children who are, you know, attending school from online here at the shelter.
So is it the equipment that was needed or connections, both?
Both, actually. We were able to get some equipment for our kids, for like the headphones that we're able to do for the online students, and with our educational technology for the fact that we have keyboards and things like that for our students who have disabilities. So we were able to get some adaptable equipment.
So is the entire grant going to the equipment for the children for learning purposes? Is there equipment that'll be used by adults, maybe whether it's for job search or for some other reason?
Actually, the adults as well can use the equipment as well. We have parents who definitely do come in. We do have a computer lab. We also allow parents who do come in our children's program who also may use the space as well and use the technology. So it's definitely much needed for both the parents and the children.
How much money did you receive in this grant?
Well, we only had received $2,390.
What else do you need that you hope might be fulfilled through other grants that will help the parents and their children who are at Women's Center and Shelter?
Well, right now we are waiting because we definitely have need for iPads that was coming in, and we also had need for maybe some laptop computers that would be, used. But we also definitely seek out other, like I said, other sources, and we are actually like awaiting those things. So right now we seem like we're doing pretty well with what we have so far.
Have the school districts that the children would be officially located in provided support or not enough?
They are. They are actually, we are always in communication with the schools, and the children are definitely issued their technology, and then we also help to set them up. We actually have a remote learning room that we have placed on our second floor.
During this time of remote learning by children, wherever they're at, their home, a shelter, parents are finding themselves as sort of teachers' aides. Is that what's happening at this shelter? And does the shelter also offer some support to help the kids, stay on track for that learning that they need?
The remote learning room, like I was mentioning, the parents are there with their kids, and also we are support to the parents as well. We are making sure that our families have everything that they need, and with we do have a collaboration with the Homeless Children Education Fund, who also offers online tutoring that they offer. If you look at it, we make sure that everything is covered as far as anything that they may basically need to help through this time. And it is hard for some parents who are, so to speak, teachers, for the first time with their children.
Earlier in the pandemic, and particularly during the shutdown, advocates were concerned about an increase in domestic violence. Has that come about, and have you seen an influx of residents to your shelter, whether they're adults or adults with their minor children?
Yes, there has been an influx, and definitely we want to make sure that we have for all the levels for our preschool children, our infants who are coming in, toddlers who are coming in with their parents, just to make sure that we have some, things that are educational for them as well. But we definitely see that influx during this pandemic. It has been hard for our families.
But you have enough room
Right now.
to temporarily shelter the families that are coming in.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Yes, indeed.
Anita Hammond is the Children's Program Supervisor for the Women's Center and Shelter of Greater Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, and it was great talking with you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.